You're listening to Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. Edie Windsor and Thea Speier met at the old Portofino restaurant, a lesbian hangout in Greenwich Village in the 1960s. It was pretty much love at first sight. By 1967, Thea proposed to her equally glamorous girlfriend with a brooch, a circle of diamonds. Before Thea died of multiple sclerosis in 2009, she and Edie flew up to Toronto to get legally married. Marriage equality wasn't legal in the United States yet, but New York State recognized such unions made in other jurisdictions. But after Thea's passing, Edie was hit with a $363,000 estate tax bill from the federal government and a $275,000 estate tax bill from New York State. Edie not only got mad, she sued all the way to the Supreme Court. In To a More Perfect Union, United States versus Windsor, Donna Saccaro, the film's director and producer, chronicles not only how Windsor and her attorney Robbie Kaplan paved the way for the eventual Supreme Court ruling that granted a constitutional right to marry for same-sex couples, but also how Edie's life and fight mirrored the LGBT rights movement in the country. Here to talk about the film are Donna Saccaro and Robbie Kaplan. Welcome both to Midday.
Thanks so much, Jonathan.
So, Donna, which compelled you more, Edie's story or the story of the LGBT civil rights movement?
Well, I'm always looking for personal stories that tell a bigger story and can bring in the history behind it. So I would say that there was so much about this story, and both Edie's personal story, Edie and Thea's love story, but also the story of the case. And then Edie and Robbie's journey together to pursue justice and dignity for her, that it then let me tell all those different stories. So I wouldn't say that it was one or the other. I wasn't looking for a story to tell the LGBTQ history or story. And actually, I consider it more the latest chapter of the civil rights movement, not just an LGBTQ story.
Right. You know, when you watch the movie, and the movie is about an hour long.
63 minutes.
And it is beautifully done. I mean, as you said, it is, you can tell as you're watching, it's telling both stories at the same time, but with a focus on Edie. And if you don't know who Edie Windsor and Thea Speier are, and you're listening, go to the Google, type in their names, and you are going to see this really beautiful, glamorous couple.
Yes, and in fact, it was just seeing Edie and Robbie speak right after the decision that got me so interested in the story, because Edie, as you said, was this incredibly glamorous, elegant, beautiful, teeny woman that took on the government with Robbie.
Right. Took on the United States. Not everybody gets to have a document thrust at them that says the United States versus put in your name.
And certainly not in your 80s.
Right. That's right. So let's go back to the beginning of the story. I mentioned how she and Thea met in the village in the 1960s. Edie was engaged to be married to a man back then, and
she actually was married.
She was married.
She was married to her older brother's best friend.
That's right. Yes,
for a year, and she felt that he was a really good guy, and she always talked about him in very generous and kind terms. And she said to him, "You deserve more, honey, and I need something else," as it says in the film.
Right, and she calls up a friend and says, you know, take me to where the lesbians are.
Right. She moved to New York, as she said, to allow herself to be gay.
Right. She says, "I actually moved to New York to let myself be gay.
Couldn't do it in Philadelphia where everybody knew me."
Right. Right. And so the film opens up with Edie saying, "There's no such thing as gay marriage. There's only marriage." And that sort of sets the tone for the movie. Can we talk about so Thea proposes to Edie, and Edie says, like, "Well, we need an engagement. Like, if I'm engaged, I want an engagement ring, but I can't wear a ring because that'll lead to all sorts of questions." What I loved about that vignette was One, you find out why she wore that brooch of that circle of diamonds all the time. But also, it talked about what life, it was emblematic of what life was like, not just in New York City, but in the United States, and dare say the rest of the world, for gay people. For her to wear an engagement ring, that would lead to all sorts of questions that could lead to the end of her career, at a minimum.
Yes. In the 60s, people had to be, gays had to be closeted. To function in society. Gays were, and that's why I tried to show the history. People were being arrested regularly. People were getting fired from their jobs. I mean, I have some footage of the government saying, if we find out someone's homosexual, we fire them.
Right.
So Edie was working at IBM, and Theo was a psychologist, and neither one of them could be known to be outwardly gay, except obviously to their friends and their close community. But even the fact that they got engaged was unheard of at that point, because the thought of ever having the opportunity to get married wasn't even in anyone's mind at that point. It was only they decided to make that commitment to each other. I mean, who would have thought that they would have ever been able to get married?
And in addition to learning about Edie's story, we then, Robbie's story is sort of folded in, and there are these great pictures of you, Robbie, from back in the day. When was that? Was that at the Gay Pride Parade? Is that in the 90s or the 80s?
Probably. I don't know. As you said, they were great photos of me, Jonathan. You could probably see my face cringe.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't know if I'd agree with that, but thank you.
Well, no, they were great photos, because it's always interesting to see photos of people you know, or photos of historic people before they became historic people, when they were still sort of accessible as someone like, oh, she wore shorts and she had hair. It was the period of the time, and she was out there, you know, marching in parades. It's talked about in the film, but talk about what happened when your parents came to visit.
Yeah, so a lot of the photos I think that Don has in the movie are from my law school graduation, and you're absolutely right. I had a really, really bad 90s haircut at that point in time.
I didn't say it was bad.
Well,
there are also
the photos
hair
from your childhood. And which, you know, I wanted to show that your photos are just like everybody else's time, childhood photos, bad hair and all.
Right. So, I mean, there are amazing parallels. Like Edie, but many years later, I kind of moved to New York in order to be gay too. And I moved here originally to go to attend Columbia Law School, but that had kind of been my plan.
You moved here from?
Well, I'd gone to college. I was, my nickname in law school was Straight Through. So I went straight through from Harvard College to Columbia Law School. But my plan for years had been to live in New York. And even when I was young, I wanted to. I don't think I appreciated at that point it was because I was gay. But at some point, I realized that I was only going to be able to truly come out in New York City, away from my hometown, which is Cleveland, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
But I was not exactly a campus radical, to say the least, when I was in school. And so I kind of waited quite some time. And it took me until the very end of my third year in law school to have the courage to come out. And it just so happens, my bad luck, that right when that was happening, my parents were visiting, and it was Gay Pride weekend. And they kind of had to snake through the crowds to get to my apartment. I was living in a one-room studio on the Upper West Side. And they got to my apartment, and I don't remember exactly what my mom said, but it was kind of like, you know, what's with the dykes on bikes? And what
who
are they
lead the parade?
Exactly. Right. And what are they so proud about? And I basically said to my mom, enough, stop. And like mothers typically do with their children, she continued. And I said, stop. And she said, why, are you gay? And I said, yes. And then it was a very small apartment. She walked 2 feet over to the edge of the kind of the corner of the room and started literally to bang her head against the wall. This is not about my mother. I feel like, you know, like I'm in an Almodovar film. It really isn't about my mother. She's apologized for this thousands and thousands of times. But that's actually what led me to know about Edie years and years before I met her.
Yes, that gets to the next question I was going to ask, which is, as a result of that, you felt, you know, I need to go talk to someone. And you end up going to see
Thea Speier.
How'd you find Thea?
So I kind of went around asking. I realized I should see someone. It was, you know, I was a pretty low period in my life. And I asked a bunch of people, I need to see a psychologist who's good at gay issues. That's the way you talked about it back then. And I got the same referral. Everyone I spoke to gave me the same person. Everyone said, go see Thea Speier. So I went to see her. She was then quite paralyzed from her MS. So you would visit her in their apartment in the living room. She talked to me, this is the incredible thing, about Edie. She said she had this amazing long-term partner, and she was a brilliant mathematician, and she had studied at NYU, and she was great at math. And years later, when I met Edie for the first time, I remember looking at her and being like, oh my God, you don't really look what I expect. I thought it was kind of going to be this geeky kind of flannel shirt, maybe thick eyeglasses with a slide rule
right
in the pocket. And I said, boy, you are not the way I pictured
it. Instead, you got like a mini-me of Lauren Bacall.
Exactly, exactly.
So you say in the film, you mentioned this just a moment ago, that you were not a radical. In the film, you say, I was not a revolutionary. So how is it that someone who is not a revolutionary, someone whose whole life was about, and at that point the future was, I'm coloring inside the lines.
Absolutely.
That's exactly what I'm going to do. At what point did you decide, maybe not, if not to be a revolutionary or a radical, that it was time for you to use your gifts and your talents in the pursuit of justice?
Well, I think I really owe that to my profession. I mean, we live in an unbelievably cynical world today where kind of all kinds of stuff gets passed around on Twitter and Facebook every 3 seconds. It's unbelievably cynical about the law and the capacity of the law to bring about justice. We even have our president tweeting about that every 3 or 4 minutes, it feels like. But I believe, I'm someone who believes and have always believed, that we have a democratic system with a court system that can achieve justice. And so from a very young age, as a litigator, I started working on cases to do that. And when I clerked for Judge Kaye on the Court of Appeals, we did the adoption case, allowing gay people to adopt in New York for the first time. And so kind of over time, I got more courage. I think the turning point for me personally was meeting my wife,
Rachel.
Rachel, who, unlike me, was a revolutionary and was kind of getting...
And still is.
And still is, and was almost getting kicked out of Smith College when I was, you know, trying to get all A's at Harvard. And she really, I think, gave me the courage to do what I've done.
Can I just add that the reason I also wanted to put in Robbie's whole personal story was that it told a different generation. And Edie started in, her story sort of starts in the 60s, but yet the sort of discrimination and the difficulties with coming out, and it, both professionally and personally, were still persisting in the 90s and in New York City and amongst the most educated group of people, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was important to show that it continued. And then, you know, when we talk about the family, which I'm sure you'll get into, that there was discrimination against these two lawyers.
Yes, we were going to get into that after we come back from the break. But thank you, Donna, for saving me from my brain freeze, because that's exactly what I was going to ask you about, the parallels between Edie and Robbie. In doing this film, Donna, other similarities, sort of maybe personality similarities, if at all, did you notice or discover between Edie and Robbie?
Well, other than the fact that they were both brilliant and incredibly articulate, and also standing up for anything and everything they believe in. I mean, Edie would correct whomever on whatever. And I think Robbie does the same thing, but you know,
that's a laugh of recognition.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it just that they're both heroes, you know.
She was a lot more glamorous than I was. So let's be honest, guys.
Which actually made it that much more effective. I mean, you know, when you talk about starting the film with "There's no such thing as gay marriage," what I did want to show was that their lives are just like everybody else's lives. Their marriage, their love, and therefore they should have the same sort of dignity, which is what you tried to do in the case as well. I tried to portray visually and audio, you know, in terms of the audio as well.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm speaking with Donna Zaccaro, who directed the documentary To a More Perfect Union, and attorney Robbie Kaplan about the groundbreaking civil rights Supreme Court case, the United States versus Windsor. We're back. This is Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and with me right now are Donna Zaccaro, director and producer of the film To a More Perfect Union, United States versus Windsor, and Robbie Kaplan, the woman who represented Edie Windsor before the Supreme Court. And I want to get into the nitty-gritty of the argument at the Supreme Court. But in the movie, when you say, I was not a revolutionary, and we were talking about this before, you did not set out to basically be an LGBTQ freedom fighter. But something happened to you and your wife, Rachel, that not opened your eyes, but where you had a personal experience with the discrimination against you and against our community.
Yeah, so Rachel, when Rachel and I got married, we also, like Edie, got married in Toronto. And when we got married, Rachel was 3 months pregnant. And our son is now 12 years old. And I was very conscious because I was I think I'm a pretty decent lawyer. So I was very conscious about papering things over to make sure that when our son was born, Rachel had him, that everything would be in place so that, God forbid, if anything happened, I would have rights and I would be involved and I would have control. And despite doing that and using, you know, very good lawyers to do so, and despite the fact that we were at a very fine hospital in Manhattan, when Jacob was born and we had to stay in the hospital for a couple of days because he had pretty serious jaundice, when we finally were allowed to take him home and I went to go to kind of the ICU room where they were getting him ready to take him in the very fancy baby seat I had ready for him, they wouldn't let me have him.
What did who was they?
The nurses who were on duty. I mean, our doctor, had she been there, I think never would have permitted it. But the nurses who were on duty, and they said, you're not the mother. Only the mother can do this. And Rachel had had a C-section, so to ask Rachel to kind of get up and do that was obviously an inconvenience and kind of showing the relationship between me and my wife, Rachel. My wife, I think, wanted to sue right there about it. And I said something like, you know, honey, I like to represent people in lawsuits. I don't want to create my own lawsuit. Let's just get him out of here as quickly as we can. And so we kind of we acceded to their demands.
In the movie, it's, at least from my notes from watching the movie, they said to you, you described it, this homophobic nurse said, quote, the real mother. That had to have stung.
Oh, absolutely. And it stung. I mean, I was so hyper. I mean, again, years before that, when I was a young lawyer clerking for Judas Kay, the then chief judge in New York, I worked on the case that allowed gay parents to adopt. So I was super hyper conscious of these issues. To have someone say that was shocking.
You said that was the first very harsh slap of discrimination that you experienced.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, look, I've lived a very privileged life. I've been very lucky. I've gone to very fine schools. And in the worlds that I've lived in, even after coming out, I can't say that I really encountered very serious discrimination before that. I'm sure people said things about me behind my back. They probably do about anyone. But that was a real kind of overt, in-your-face slap. And it was shocking to both of us.
And it showed the discrimination against families and just how different it is for gay parents as opposed to straight parents. I mean, you don't have to prove that you're the father to put it on the birth certificate. Father could pick up the, you know, if it was
correct.
Straight.
They don't
couple
ask for
having
blood
a
test.
Baby.
Correct.
No.
And the hoops that you jumped through on purpose to ensure that what happened to you wouldn't happen was something in the, Jacob was born in the 2000s?
12 years ago. He's 12 years old.
Okay, so yeah.
2006, May.
Right.
Yeah.
So even then.
April 4/5/06.
Oh, that's easy to remember.
Yeah, very good.
But even then, as early as 2006 or as late as 2006, LGBT families had to go through all these legal hoops, have all these papers in place to ensure that all of their rights were spelled out for the, you know, the homophobic nurse or the callous, you know, police officer, you name it, to ensure that your rights and dignity were affirmed and recognized.
And imagine if they weren't two high-powered New York lawyers. I mean,
right.
This was taking place in New York City with two lawyers.
In
so 2006. What is it like in the rest of the country?
Right. And that gets to all those court cases that were filed and bubbled up. So let's talk about how did you, Robbie, meet Edie, and this then becomes, you become her lawyer.
So almost two decades after I saw Thea as a patient, I got a call from a friend of mine who was kind of acts as a headhunter for big law firms. And he said, I know this woman, her spouse, Thea Spire, died, and she has this big estate tax bill, and she wants to fight it. And she's looking for a lawyer. She's been turned down, and would you talk to her?
She's been turned down by the other LGBTQ organization.
Yeah. He certainly said she'd been turned down. I came to learn that it was by the other kind of LGBT groups. And when he said the Aspire and Edie Windsor, again, I'd never met her, but I knew exactly who it was. And I said, okay, I'm absolutely happy and be delighted to do this.
Before you go, what was the rationale of the other, of the LGBT organizations for not taking on Edie's case?
Well, according to Edie, what they said to her was, this isn't the right case. It isn't the right time for the movement. They felt that they should be focusing on employment discrimination, housing discrimination, more bread and butter issues than marriage. Marriage was sort of gravy or icing on the cake. And they felt she was too rich. People wouldn't be able to relate to her. You know, it wasn't the right sort of case as far as they were concerned.
And Robbie,
so you saw it as
you saw
the opposite.
It differently.
Completely the opposite. So I basically went over to her house the next day, and I didn't have to ask for the address. I knew where it was. And I walked in, and as I said before, I was shocked by like her kind of glamorousness, her glamour. And we started to talk, and she told me the story about her and Thea, and it immediately was clear to me that this was the perfect case.
What made it perfect?
Because she was so articulate, because she was so glamorous, because the marriage that she had with Thea was the marriage that any American would want to have. And because I knew that my ultimate audience, ultimately I knew this issue was going to get to the Supreme Court. I didn't know if it would be Edie's case or not. But I knew that our ultimate audience were justices who were essentially her age. Hmm. And that they would be able to understand the life that she lived, and they would be able to see her marriage as being no different than their own. And I knew if I could prove that and convince them of that, that we would win the case.
Plus, you also felt that estate taxes were something that everybody hated,
right,
and could relate to. And you could put, right, actually, as Jeff Toobin says in the film, an exact price on discrimination.
And you know, and that you make that point in the film, Donna. But your point, Robbie, just now about the audience would be justices who were her age and knew who she was just by benefit of being from the same generation was something I had not even factored in. But as you point out, Donna, also everyone hates the state taxes, even though maybe most Americans won't have to deal with it. But there's a certain unfairness to it that seems to spin. No matter who you are, your station in life, if you're hit with an estate tax, people will rally around you because they think it's wrong and
unfair.
Well,
and in this case, if she had been married to someone named, as she said, Theo instead of Thea for 5 minutes before Theo died, she would have not paid a cent in estate taxes.
Mm-hmm. So, Robbie, when you took the case, and the big LGBT organizations had already said no, and they're like, this is not the right time, and she's not the right person. How did that impact you and your relationships with people who I'm sure you probably knew? Did that change your relationship at all? Did any of them think, you know, like, my God, what are you doing? You're going to hurt us.
So, I don't know what I would have done. Mary Bonato, who's the lawyer who went on to win Obergefell, two years after Windsor, had already brought a DOMA case in Massachusetts in federal court. And so I took comfort in that. I knew while a lot of people didn't agree with that, the fact that someone with a record who actually won the right to marriage for the first time in Massachusetts in state court, someone with that record, if she was willing to do it, then that gave me some amount of sustenance, I think. We had a lot of conversations with Edie at the beginning that I had kind of forgotten about and then refreshed myself about, you know, if the gay organizations attack you, are you willing to do this? Like, it could be get rough for you. Fortunately, that never happened, so she didn't have to worry about that. But it was something we thought about a lot at the beginning, for sure.
Now, in preparation for the case, Donna, I love the fact that in the film you have, is Nina Totenberg?
Yes.
Yeah, Nina Totenberg has this wonderful moment where she talks about how she, Robbie, you and the team were desperate to keep Edie from talking about what? During all of the hearings and everything.
Sex.
In fact, they had a mantra, she and Thea. Edie's mantra was, don't postpone joy. And Thea's was, keep it hot. And, I mean, it's a human thing, but why be so afraid to let Edie just not postpone joy, not be thoroughly herself?
So, you know, Edie passed away last September, mm-hmm. And may she rest in peace. I still think about her almost every day and miss her terribly. But she really, really, really liked to talk about sex. Let me be crystal clear about that. And even before, as we're getting ready for the case, I remember having conversations with her, and I was like, I kind of wanted to go into another room. I'm quite prude about that, and I was like, oh, I really can't be having these conversations with you. And then when we started the case, I remember we had an early press conference, and some nice young gay man said, you know, how have you been able to sustain a relationship for so long? And she started to say, keep it hot, and then went into some detail about how she kept it hot. And I pulled her aside afterwards and I said, look, Edie, like, you, I promise you, when the case is over, you can do this all you want. She held me to that promise. But while this case is going on, you do have to censor yourself about this. I don't want the American people or the judges, or if we ever get there, the Supreme Court justices, to think about your sex life. I want you to think about your dignity and your marriage and in sickness and in health. I understand that sex is a part of that, but let's keep it out of the case until we win the case.
Now, in the film, Donna, you do a very good job, even though we all know how the story ends, you do a very good job of building the drama up to the moment there at the Supreme Court. There's another moment in the film that I didn't know about, Robbie, where you talk about all the amicus briefs that you're trying to get for your case. And you are determined to get former President Bill Clinton to go on the record saying that his signing the so-called Defense of Marriage Act into law was a mistake and wrong. And if I remember right, you called a friend of Clinton and said, if he had something to say about DOMA, now is the time to do it. Now is the time to make it right. I didn't know about that. How much time elapsed between that phone call to your mutual Clinton friend and the op-ed that appeared, I believe, in the New York Times?
It's in the Washington Post.
I'm sorry, Washington Post. Ooh, that's a really bad mistake on my part.
My guess is 2 months, no more than 2 months. It was pretty fast. I mean, he immediately agreed, is my understanding, and then it was just a process of writing what he was going to say. And I have to say, you know, again, I keep saying the same thing. We live in this world where everyone's so cynical. You know, sometimes people do things, even in politics, because it's the right thing to do. And there's no question that's what he did there. And it was extremely helpful because I was very worried about questions from the court. You know, Ms. Kaplan, President Clinton signed this into law, was passed by huge majorities in Congress. Are you telling me that Bill Clinton's a homophobe? Is that your position? And by getting him to write that op-ed in that very principled way that he did, I got some other questions, but we avoided at least that question.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we had to show the shift that took place because 1996 was not that much.
It wasn't that far removed.
And so you had to show that not only was there a cultural shift towards acceptance, there had to be a political shift. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty dramatic. So you had to explain, you know, how was it? That's, I had Richard Socarides talking about how was it that President Clinton, who was a champion of gay and lesbian rights, signed this into law. So you had to explain the politics behind it and then his evolution as well.
And you also, speaking of evolution, show the evolution of President Obama sitting down with Robin Roberts of ABC to show that, you know, he was coming out for marriage equality subsequent to his vice president going on Meet the Press to say that he thought same-sex couples should get married. So now we're in the Supreme Court. And Robbie, you and I had dinner I think a few months before the arguments, and you taught me something. I remember asking you, so how much time do you have to do all of this, thinking, you know, Perry Mason courtroom issue? And you said, I have 30 minutes. And
Not even that, 15.
And I said, okay, so 15 minutes to give your opening statement. And you said, no, 15 minutes altogether. And I was like, wait, so how do you even prepare for that? You might have a speech, but you then told me the justices can interrupt you at any moment. So how do you prepare for something like that?
So what you do is, or at least what I did, is I spent a lot of time being tortured. So I spent about 3 months doing what's called moot courts, where you sit in a room with a bunch of very esteemed lawyers, and they pretend they're various justices. Everyone always wanted to play Scalia. And they ask you questions as if you're arguing, usually for 40 minutes. And then the really fun part happens. They spend about another hour kind of critiquing every word that came out of your mouth. And so by the end of that process, we did about 13 of those, at least, I think. By the end of that process, you kind of have to have everything almost in like brain memory. It has to be kind of in your cell, so that when you're asked a certain question, it's almost like pressing a button and you know what to say.
Reflexive.
And after that kind of intense preparation, I think I was there. It was intense. I have to say, you know, I speak in court for a living all the time, and almost every judge that I deal with, especially in the South, tells me I'm speaking too fast. One nice thing about the Supreme Court is no one tells you you're speaking too fast at the Supreme Court.
And, you know, to your point about sort of brain memory in order to just hit a button, Donna shows you talking about in the film how basically you used, everyone was focused on Justice Kennedy, and you used Justice Kennedy's own words.
In a prior decision
there in the court. The film actually does a great job of giving you a peek inside how the justices relate to each other, how they talk to each other, either not to each other, but through the person, through Robbie standing there, and to be able to hurl Justice Kennedy's words back at him. How'd that feel?
Well, so everyone knew that his vote was the crucial vote here. And, you know, I didn't want to say, as Justice Ginsburg, I think, had said during the argument, as Justice Kennedy said, as Justice Kennedy did, as Justice Kennedy held. That would have, I thought, being a little bit too obvious for me. So hoping for subtlety, but completely failing to accomplish subtlety, I used just some of the words that he'd written. And probably the most famous phrase that he's written in the area of gay rights so far is comes from his Lawrence opinion, where he talks about times can blind us to certain truths. So I used it during the argument. When I said it, you know, I remember the Chief Justice, who was kind of sitting right in front of me. I mean, I scored no points for subtlety. He knew exactly what I was doing. Everyone on the court knew what I was doing. But I think they got the point.
But message sent.
But it also explained exactly what you were trying to convey. So it wasn't just using his words.
Right.
It was the right message.
Right, exactly. As Don had said, what's happened with respect to gay rights is really people changing over time. And that's what Justice Kennedy was trying to explain.
And so, Donna, with this film, this is Pride Month. Edie Windsor, the year of anniversary of her death is coming up in September. What do you hope people will come away with from your movie?
Well, the reason I did the movie again was because I thought this story needed to be told. I thought all the stories within it needed to be told. I also feel that there's a paucity of stories about women and women heroes and leaders. And this was a hero. This is an American hero. And this story made our country, I believe, a better place. And it enabled us to get closer to what is our promise of a perfect union of equality. So that's what I'm hoping they'll come away with. And, and also obviously changing the cultural conversation to some extent, because we're still seeing cases brought up, and there's been somewhat of a backlash in this current political environment. So,
And real quickly, Robbie, before I let you go, you're also involved in a lawsuit against the white supremacist neo-Nazis who unleashed that terror on Charlottesville. What's the latest on that?
So the latest is we argued, Karen Dunn and I argued the motions to dismiss in that case. I guess it was about a week and a half ago. We expect a decision very soon. I don't want to jinx anything, but I'm comfortable that the case is going to proceed. And we're going to have about 9 months of taking depositions of a bunch of alt-right white supremacists and neo-Nazis.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I've been speaking with Donna Sicaro, who directed the documentary To a More Perfect Union, and attorney Robbie Kaplan about the groundbreaking civil rights Supreme Court case, the United States versus Windsor. Robbie, Donna, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Jonathan. Much.